Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Can renewable energy become the prime source of energy for America and for the rest of the world? Well, what would it take to do that? How do we make that transition? Does this mean a downgrade in our quality of life? These questions are tackled in the book Energy Revolution, The Physics and the Promise of Efficient Technology by Harvard physicist Mara Prentice. Mara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk with you.
Our phone lines are open. If you want to join this conversation, you are invited. The number is 210-614-8980, 614-8980. Mara, you quote Dick Cheney in your book. He said in 2001, conservation may be a sign of personal virtue, but it is not a sufficient basis for a sound, comprehensive energy policy. And your reaction to that quote?
I think that he's absolutely right, that it also is a question of what conservation means. People of a certain age, which is mine, have horrifying memories of, you know, suggestions that everyone should wear cardigans and turn down their sweaters, et cetera, and freeze in their houses, and that this was going to be fabulous. Clearly, it is not fabulous. On the other hand, conservation has really changed its meaning. We waste more than 60% of the energy that we extract, and a huge amount of that is released as heat into the environment. If we take that away, we could reduce our energy use by two-thirds with zero lifestyle sacrifice. And it's these kind of opportunities that have me very excited. I'm not trying to go back to old arguments about how much people are willing to torture themselves for the sake of the environment. I want to suggest that not only do we not have to torture ourselves, but our lives can be much better.
So your book is not, you know, talking about that, the ideological reasoning for why we should have renewable energy. You're looking at the facts from a scientific basis, looking at what is doable, what is possible, what we're capable of doing, right?
Yes, I wanted people to be able to make their own decisions.
And so, but when you say that, I want to get back into this Dick Cheney thing a little bit. I mean, it sounds like if we could save two-thirds of the energy that is used through conservation, that conservation should be a big part of a comprehensive energy policy.
Ah, but it's the word conservation. I think that the sense that Vice President Cheney intended was not doing something, as in turning down your heat. And what I'm talking about is making a technical change. A gasoline engine, for example, has a fundamentally physics-limited efficiency that, in practical terms, is less than 50%. If you switch to an electric motor, there is no fundamental limit. And existing commercially available off-the-shelf electric motors achieve better than 98% efficiency. So by switching from a gasoline engine to an electric motor, you could remove that loss without what I think was intended originally as conservation.
Okay, our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980. Jim has called in. Jim, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks for taking the call. Yeah, the comment a moment ago is interesting on the electric motors. There's a loss prior to the electricity available to the motor, and I'd be curious, one, if that's being factored into that comment. But more importantly, I greatly agree with the need for the technological shift. And I'm interested if she could comment, please, on the specifics of how we would quickly, not over 100 or 300 years, but how we would quickly make that shift.
Okay, Jim, thank you for that call. Appreciate it. And so, Mara.
Okay, well, there were two different questions there. One is he highlighted a fabulous point, that burning rule that applies to engines also applies to electric generators in power plants. So if you just get the electricity for your electric car from a power plant, you don't win much. You win a little bit, but not a lot. And so that is a very crucial point. What you win from is getting the electricity from a renewable source and then using it in the car. And that's where you get the huge win. Just hiding the loss in the power plant doesn't help. And how quickly can we do it? Examples come from looking in other places. on a windy day last fall, Denmark, a big industrial country, generated more than 100% of the electricity that they use. So that's not a future scenario. That was last November. And Germany, another major industrial country, on a sunny summer day, generated more than 50% of their electricity from solar. So that's right now, today, 100% and 50% in big industrial countries. And those shifts were made over roughly a 10-year scale.
Back to the phone lines with Hugh. Hugh, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about nuclear power, which is a fraud, because every nuclear power plant has to be built with government loan guarantees. The riskiest part of building a nuclear power plant is that it'll wind up as an expensive hole in the ground. There are lots of those. At the other end, a nuclear disaster can only be insured by a country. Nobody else has the resources. And in between, the French, who are the best at this, 5 years ago, their plants are river water cooled, and in the height of a heat wave, they had to shut down their nuclear system because they couldn't cool the reactors.
Okay, Hugh, thank you for that call. Appreciate it. So, Amara, nuclear power, is that what you consider renewable energy?
I did not consider it renewable energy. I was considering only hydro, solar, and wind, and either solar or wind could provide 100% of the U.S. energy very feasibly.
Solar or wind? I mean, one or the other. You don't even need to have the both.
Correct. And the numbers are actually surprisingly small. We could get 100% of our energy from solar using about 1% of the U.S. land area.
So we've also talked a lot about, you know, real-time sensors and digital calculations in order to save energy. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, there are several senses of that. One has been going on for a very long time. Cars and planes used to have to adjust the engine to be roughly right for the average conditions. They can now very precisely tune it for exactly what's happening. That's produced a lot of gains, and there are going to be a lot more gains just coming from being able to change an object so it's doing only what it needs to do instead of doing on average what it needs to do. And that's one huge opportunity. Second one is allowing us to avoid doing things that simply waste energy, like driving around looking for a parking place. I was amazed at how much energy goes into that in big cities. An app that can find you a parking place quickly will improve everyone's disposition and improve energy a lot. So I think there are a variety of senses, personally tuning it, having it only heat where you are. If I'm sitting on my Barca Lounger watching television, I can just have the Barca Lounger heated and not toast the rest of the house, for example, and it could follow me around. I'd always be warm. The cat and the dog would always have to stay close, of course. But
That's a benefit. So we're talking about smarter users, smarter engines, all sorts of smarter appliances as ways to conserve energy. I don't know if that's a bad word or not, but we're going to dig more into that. So what does that mean in regards to smart grids, smart meters? Our conversation continues. We're going to take a one-minute break. We're talking with the author of The Energy Revolution, The Physics and the Promise of Efficient Technology. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line is Mara Prentice. She's the author of Energy Revolution, The Physics and the Promise of Efficient Technology. We've learned from her so far that the United States wastes about two-thirds of our energy consumption. About 80% of that is in transportation. We just burn off a lot of energy that goes off into the atmosphere. It should not allow to happen. And so we could make a change, a switch over to renewable energy for all of our energy needs without any lifestyle sacrifice. So, Mara, let me ask you about smart grids and smart meters. People are afraid of smart meters. Have you run into that?
Yes, there's an issue with privacy in all of the interconnected world. I'm not sure I want Google to know what I'd put into my refrigerator either. But as everything becomes more interconnected, that's going to be more of an issue. On the other hand, things like smart grids and smart meters offer a huge chance to make energy more profitable without bothering anyone. One of the biggest problems is surge capacity. In Boston, for example, we really want energy to run those air conditioners in July, and that's electricity that's not required for the rest of the year. So people have to maintain enough capacity to do that. Whereas in Florida, apparently the winter is the worst because of the electric heaters. So the ability to spread capacity so that each plant operated at 100% all of the time makes any investment in energy, including fossil fuel burning, much more efficient. And that doesn't necessarily save energy, but it helps energy companies. And so thinking about the smart grid, I want to extend beyond just renewables and simply making less waste, even economically.
So I know that in your book you deliberately kept saying, well, we're not talking about the social element of this this conversion, but you know, it is a big part of what has to happen, and the smart meter obstacle is, I think, a great example, because people are afraid of Big Brother eavesdropping on their energy use, and so how do we get over that hump?
Well, one method is if you put solar on your own house, then they know a lot less, because you then have your own solar consumption plus or minus what you take from the grid.
So you've outsmarted the smart meter.
Yes. That's given you your privacy back. And it's a big shift in power. Owning the sources of production is a big change, and one can do that by making a trip to your favorite hardware store and buying a solar panel.
So we've got entire industries that are wrapped up in selling us power, pulling it out of the ground and burning it up to spin turbines and sending it to my house. And if everyone puts solar panels on their house, what's going to happen to all these industries? Aren't they trying to resist this?
They are, and that's a major political issue at the moment. There's a good deal playing out in Congress where people are trying to discuss wins and losses, and there's a lot of covert dealing going on about forming allies across things. You have raised a big question. It's a huge shift in power if you can do it yourself.
Back to the phone lines, and the number is 614-8980 if you want to join the conversation with Mara Prentice, author of Energy Revolution, The Physics and the Promise of Efficient Technology. Brian has called in. Brian, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, excellent topic. I just had one quick point about the wind turbines. I was a biologist for a bunch of wind farms across the Southwest for about 3 years, and a lot of people told me they killed a bunch of birds. I saw very, very few birds killed, and I think it's because we do a lot better job situating the wind farms in areas that are not on like major bird flyways. I wonder if you could elaborate on that just a little bit.
All right, Brian, thanks for your question. Mara.
There was a great story from Bloomberg about the number one cause of bird death in the United States, and by a factor of more than 10, it's cats. If you add up all of the deaths associated with wind turbines, they are less than a tenth of domestic cats.
But there is a trade-off. You talk about trade-offs as we make any change in the economy and energy economy. Can you talk about that wider? What trade-offs should we be looking for?
Well, I think that's the dialogue that I would like people to start having, that there are trade-offs of what's economically advantageous, which is what I mentioned, the smart grid helping even fossil fuel producers. And so there are a lot of things that are not problematic, and the areas that are problematic are marginal changes. And a big factor, for example, is if you put up a new wind farm and there isn't increased electricity demand, that means a fossil fuel burning plant is going to become less profitable. So you're asking people to take a profit hit in the interest of the renewables. But if you switch to more electric cars, that may not happen. There's more electricity demand, and so the electricity people won't take it, but oil producers will. because then less oil is being consumed. And so I can't decide what other people want, but I want people to talk about it so they make the decisions that are right for them.
Well, I know that in South Texas, particularly along the border, that there's concerns about as wind farms expand that they are wiping out some of the rare habitat in the desert for some threatened cactus. And people may roll their eyes and say, but it is a rare ecosystem, and this is a cactus, and it's sacred to certain peoples in the United States, and they don't want to see that happen.
And I think that that's an important series of questions to ask. Any change is going to have some consequences that almost certainly are going to cause some shift that may not initially be appreciated. And those are very difficult trade-offs. One of the questions about wind farms that nobody is certain of is how much they would change the weather. Small wind farms obviously aren't a big deal, but if we were to power the entire U.S. with wind farms, would that start to shift winds enough to change weather or climate? And I don't think anybody knows.
Or if we can have larger conversations and try and get more buy-in from these other groups that are concerned about something that other people may overlook and say, hey, this is important to us, and this needs to be considered as well. If we just Bigfoot on these issues, eventually it does catch up to you.
Absolutely. And that was a lot of the reason I wrote the book, was that I see a huge amount of stuff, particularly on the Internet, which is contradictory. And if I'm a person just trying to decide what on earth are they telling me, it's very frustrating. So I tried to compile information that I think is reliable so people can look at it and say, okay, this is where we are. This is what's possible, and then choose what range of possibilities is advantageous for us.
So we're seeing already that energy consumption in the United States is basically steady. It's plateaued. What does that mean? It's falling. So what does that mean in regards to your book?
I think that it provides a big opportunity. If energy use were rising inexorably, eventually we couldn't possibly have enough energy. Anything finite is going to be exceeded by anything infinitely growing. But it's not. It's been falling since 2008. And GDP dollars per energy use has been shifting favorably for a long time. Energy use per capita has been going down for a long time. Air conditioners are vastly more efficient than they were. And that's another example of conservation where no one's asking you to change your thermostat. You can keep it at 65 still, but the amount of energy that takes to do that is about half of what it took 20 years ago. And those gains are projected to continue. Those are huge opportunities to conserve without lifestyle shift. And that's a lot of what I'd like to emphasize.
So a lot of what you're talking about is already happening. It's happening right now, and it has been happening for a while.
Yes, in fact, for the first time 2 or 3 years ago, the majority of energy consumed in residences was not consumed by heating and cooling.
But people still have a lot of bad habits, things like the vampire chargers you mentioned in your book.
What are those? Those are chargers that are simply left plugged in when nothing's on it. You know, you charge your cell phone and leave it in the wall when you rush to the office. Many of them continue to consume power all day, pointlessly. And that's another place where computing makes a difference. You can make a charger that doesn't do that.
So how much power are we losing with vampire chargers? How much is that into my energy bill?
California, I believe, argued it was something like 10%. And that was some years ago. But that had been their figure of things that are simply left plugged in. And that kind of shift would be good. Or the boxes on DVRs, those use a huge amount. The TV boxes use about a kilowatt.
So if my cable is running all day long, I'm not there, or my modems and everything else, but I'm not home. So if we were able to get a 10% cut to my energy bill, people would be celebrating. So you could do that at home just by figuring out a way to unplug all of these chargers you don't use.
Yes, sir. I actually put mine on power strips and I flip the whole thing when I leave.
So is this something that your book is very practical, a lot of colorful graphics. You really dig into the numbers. And but you think people can use this to – you don't get ideological, but, you know, what is the ideological reason why you wrote the book?
I feel that we have a huge opportunity to make the world a better place. Energy use is doing a lot of bad things. If you look at China and India right now, there's a huge domestic issue there about air quality and emission of particles.
It's cutting back lifespan. People are dying, you know?
Yes. That people estimate at the World Bank something between 3 and 6 years of life on average is lost. And for kids, it's even worse. For children who breathe that kind of air growing up, they never recover the lung function they would have had. Those are terrible things. And that is a problem in the developing world that they are aware of. Carbon is something that people get nervous about as developing, but no one wants their kid growing up in a place where they can't breathe.
Mara Prentice is the author of Energy Revolution, The Physics and the Promise of Efficient Technology. This is The Source. Thanks for tuning us in.